keeping democracy alive.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
We're really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
Yeah, Lyndon Johnson, you sure know about that. Well, talk about the dignity of man. Sometimes our economic systems really do affect human dignity. It's not fun to be poor. I suppose it's great fun to be extremely, extremely wealthy. I don't know. It seems a bit odd to me. But for many, many years, as Gore Vidal said, we've had socialism for the very richest and free enterprise for everyone else. And recently, there's a poll that came out. I don't have the source, unfortunately. Maybe you do, our guest, Lawrence Whitner, that says 66% of Americans agree with what you and I think of as socialism, not the socialism for the rich that we've had, but real socialism. Well, what is socialism? I don't know how many people really know what it means, but I've heard it said that when Americans hear the word socialism, we stop thinking right then and there. Then again, thousands of enthusiastic supporters have recently filled halls across America beyond their capacity to cheer Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, who has called himself a socialist. He's been very, very popular with liberals and conservatives in Vermont. And as Bob Dylan sang so many years ago, and it seems to be true, something is happening here, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jones? What is it with the word socialism? Why has it been so forbidden to even speak its name for so much of the 20th and now 21st century? Could it be that Americans are finally over our reflexive revulsion at something we have never known what it really is? Well, our guest today on Keeping Democracy Alive is Dr. Lawrence Whitner, whose new article raises the question, will Americans vote for a democratic socialist? Dr. Whitner, Lawrence, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thank you.
Well,
I'm glad to be here today.
Lawrence Whitner is a prominent American historian who has combined intellectual life with activism for peace and social justice. Professor Whitner is the author of 9 books, the editor or co-editor of another 4, and the writer of over 250 published articles and book reviews. His most ambitious scholarly project thus far has been his Struggle Against the Bomb trilogy, One World or None, Resisting the Bomb, and Toward Nuclear Abolition, a history of the worldwide nuclear disarmament movement. Numerous organizations have celebrated his activism with awards, including Citizen Action, Peace Action, United University Professions, and Veterans for Peace. Great organization. Currently, he's a national board member of Peace Action, the largest peace organization in the U.S., and on occasion, he performs vocally and on the banjo with the Solidarity Singers, who enliven a variety of venues, picket lines, rallies, prisons, and conventions of the American Historical Association with their music. His newest book is What's Going On at U Aardvark. U Aardvark. It's a fast-paced political satire about how an increasingly corporatized modern American university becomes the site of a rambunctious rebellion that turns the nation campus life upside down. It's a comic romp through what has become a serious issue in contemporary America, the corporate takeover of higher education. Well, the corporate takeover of everything, really. Today in America, certainly we have an increasingly wealthy 1/10 of 1%, and a nearly totally decimated middle class, which our founders recognized was essential to maintain a democracy and to keep a Republican form of government. Bernie Sanders talks a lot about this in his surging campaign. The last time we had such unequal distribution of wealth, I believe, was the Gilded Age, which was back in the 1890s. Then democratic socialism took on that injustice head-on, and we had the reforms of the early 20th century, championed eventually by President Theodore Roosevelt. As our guest Lawrence Whitner writes, during the first two decades of the 20th century, the idea of democratic socialism, democratic control of the economy, now there's a definition, had substantial popularity in the U.S. How did that happen, Dr. Whitner? And paint a picture of that context, please.
Well, certainly during the late 19th century, a time of rapid industrial growth in the United States and in Western Europe as well, there were numerous injustices brought on by this growing corporate control of the economy and increasingly of U.S. politics. Mistreatment of workers, mass misery, the development of slums in major cities, the poisoning of the population with drugs that were advertised to be one thing and were often, in fact, something else. Food that was rotten or treated with chemicals that were destroying the consuming public. A whole range of things that the public was dismayed about. And increasingly, writers took on these issues. They exposed the corporate control of American politics. They developed reform movements, such as the agrarian reform movement called the populists. There was a progressive movement inside both major parties. And most dramatically, they developed the Socialist Party of America. Its leader was Eugene Debs, a prominent labor leader of the time. He had founded the American Railway Union, and other union activists were also inspired by the rise of this Socialist Party in the United States, just as they were in Western Europe and in some other places such as Australia and New Zealand. So a socialist movement developed to combat the abuses of corporate capitalism in the late 19th century.
So then it sounds like there were the plutocrats, the oligarchs, but the two parties at the time, who were very different from what they are now, weren't really taking that on. Was that the case, that they were ignoring that issue? I mean, Teddy Roosevelt eventually got to it, but was there no voice taking on the plutocratic rule over America, except for the socialists?
Well, the Populist Party did so during the late 19th century, but it collapsed after several campaigns.
Right.
And there were some reformers who moved into the Democratic and Republican parties. But for the most part, those parties remained under the control of the new corporate rich.
Right.
And most of the reformers and socialists turned to this new Socialist Party. Mm-hmm. It was only after the Socialist Party, during the first decade or so of the 20th century, began to win elections or to seriously challenge the Democrats and the Republicans for control of cities and states, and even at times to elect members of Congress, that the reform wings of the Democratic and Republican parties surged to the fore, largely as a response to the socialists, to head off the socialists, and enacted things such as the Pure Food and Drug Act, and women's suffrage, and minimum wage and maximum hour laws and so on. So the mainstream parties responded to the socialist challenge by, in some cases, at least stealing the socialist program and enacting them themselves.
Well, it sounds like, I mean, certainly some of the major players these days, I mean, so much of that sounds like a carbon copy almost of what's going on today. You know, some of the major players in the, at least the Democratic Party, are being, at least having to mouth the words, whether they mean it. I'm talking specifically about Hillary Clinton, you know, being pulled to the left, where she's never been on the left. But, you know, they do what they need to do sometimes. But then again, you know, we have Bernie Sanders, and one of the politicians in American history that school kids have read about is Upton Sinclair, who wrote that very famous book, The Jungle, about how, you know, without any kind of government oversight, incredibly unsafe working conditions and unsanitary food was the result, but the socialists pushed it, and Upton Sinclair was himself a socialist who very nearly won election as governor of California, and I believe it was 1932, it may have been 34, I'm not sure.
It was 34, yeah. And in fact, while Sinclair began as a zealous socialist, a supporter of the Socialist Party and its candidates, in 1934, he ran for the Democratic nomination for governor of California, and he won it.
That's right.
And he campaigned in that year as a Democrat, and he nearly won. He ran what was basically a Democratic Socialist campaign, but as a Democrat, and he did very well. The corporate establishment in California was just horrified and united against him.
Right.
But Sinclair's campaign was called End Poverty in California.
Oh, right.
And he proposed public ownership and production for use rather than for profit. And he took up all the socialist ideas of his past and the Socialist Party's ideas as well.
Well, we have a candidate now who is running for the Democratic nomination for president, not for governor of California, of course. That's Bernie Sanders. And what was the Socialist Party's agenda back when it had some strength? When Eugene Debs ran for president, he did remarkably well. Maybe you could talk about what Debs and other candidates and actual office holders and the power of the Socialist Party and socialists in general in the United States. It wasn't such a bad word then. There were a lot of elected members of the Socialist Party and, of course, Eugene Debs.
Right. Well, in 1912, for example, the United States had a much smaller population than today.
Oh, yeah.
The Socialist Party had 118,000 dues-paying members, and its presidential candidate, Eugene Debs, drew roughly 1 million votes for the presidency. Now, 1 million votes today may still strike us as a fairly small vote, but again, the population of the United States was much smaller, and the winning candidate, the Democrat, Woodrow Wilson, drew only 6 million votes.
Hmm.
So Debs was doing remarkably well, and the American Socialist Party was really comparable at that time to the British Labour Party and the French Socialist Party and other Western European political parties that were gradually rising to power. And it was assumed that the Socialist Party would also begin to run the United States, elected by the people and acting for the people. And in fact, that same year, the party held 1,200 public offices.
Wow.
In 340 cities, including 79 mayors in 24 states. So there were mayors in many big cities, such as Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. as well as in smaller cities like Butte, Montana, and Schenectady, New York. So the Socialist Party was a thriving political party at that point, and seemed on the verge of becoming one of America's mainstream political parties.
Interesting. And you write that the Democratic and the Republican parties, faced with this threat to their political future, turned to supporting progressive agendas that stole the socialist thunder. What was the socialist thunder? What was their thunder?
They were calling for things that seemed very avant-garde at that time. Women's suffrage, for example. They were calling, of course, for regulation of the meatpacking industry, and indeed of all corporations, such as the railroad lines, which were the major corporations of the time. They were calling for workers' rights and the right to form labor unions. Unions were, of course, frequently suppressed, not just by management, but by the government as well. Strikes were broken when federal or state troops were sent in to break them up and arrest union leaders. And in fact, Debs had been arrested during the great Pullman strike of 1894. So the Socialist Party supported workers' rights, and workers rallied to it. The party, of course, had a long-range vision, not only of so-called immediate reforms, but also of public ownership and control of the American economy.
Interesting. You talk about public ownership. That makes me think of a lot of things. Lately, there's been a lot of discussion about net neutrality on the Internet. And there was recently a court ruling that, yes, the Internet is a public utility, that is something that we, all of us, depend on and therefore shall be regulated as a public utility. And so that has, you know, there are those corporate powers that were very, very much against that. They wanted to have different levels of the Internet, one for paying customers, one for everybody else, and that has been struck down. So there's an example of perhaps a little bit of socialism, the idea of a public utility. We have gas, we have electricity, we have water, all these things we depend on. Well, we depend on an awful lot of things these days, and you know, to have us whipped around. I mean, there are people who's head of water companies who say, no, the public has no right to drinking water. I think a lot of people disagree with that. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is Professor Lawrence Wittner, an American historian. We're talking about, will Americans vote for a democratic socialist? It's happened before, and who knows? It may happen again. Of course, the word socialist, people tend to react reflexively that, oh, it's a bad word or something like that, but it was really strong. And I want to talk just for a few minutes about the demise of socialism. The socialists vociferously opposed the entry of the U.S. into the disastrous First World War, and I would certainly agree that it was a terrible mistake for the U.S. to get into it because it made World War II happen, but that's another story. What were the reasons why the socialists opposed U.S. entry into the First World War? And then how did that position, opposing the war, affect their standing among U.S. citizens as we did enter that war?
The Socialist Party of the United States, like its counterparts in other nations, the British Labor Party, the German Social Democratic Party, the Swedish Social Democratic Party, and so on, believed that the wealthy of the world and their colonialist, imperialist policies were driving the nations of the world toward an imperialist war, which in fact happened,
yes.
World War One.
Yes.
So they vowed in the years before the war to oppose an imperialist war. And so when the war broke out, the American socialists said that they would not support that war for empire on the part of Germany or on the part of Britain or on the part of any of the powers that were fighting for imperial gain.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that position was a popular position in the United States. And the United States didn't enter the war when it began
right.
in 1914. It stayed out of the war. And President Wilson, the Democrat, campaigned in 1916 with the slogan, "He kept us out of war," so that keeping out of an imperialist war was a very popular position in the United States, although there were some forces that were pressing for intervention. But in early 1917, Wilson decided that the United States should enter the war, and he brought a declaration of war to Congress. And while the socialists continued to oppose that, he got the declaration of war through Congress with a majority, although there was a substantial minority against it, and the war was on. The socialists continued to take a strong anti-war stand,
mm-hmm.
but from that point on, the forces of nationalism and flag waving and super patriotism were working against them. So while their vote actually went up in the local municipal elections of 1917, the government moved in to repress them.
Yes.
The Espionage Act was passed in 1917. The Sedition Act was passed in 1918. And these two federal laws gave the government the right to fine and imprison people for up to 20 years for opposing war, for reducing enlistment in the armed forces. It gave the right to the government to censor newspapers,
yeah.
to keep them from using the U.S. mail. Or other publications such as magazines. So it was a major political and civil liberties crackdown at the time, and it was used to destroy the Socialist Party. Thousands of Socialist Party leaders were prosecuted. Many of them served prison terms, including the party standard bearer, Eugene Debs, who had made a speech in Canton, Ohio, where the local Socialist Party leaders had already been sent to jail. And he made a speech before a large sympathetic crowd saying that the master class has always declared the wars and the subject class has always fought the battles.
Right.
A rather strong way of saying that it's a rich man's war and a poor man's fight, which had been the stance of the socialists all along. But he was prosecuted for saying that, and he received a 10-year prison term and was packed off to federal prisons, ending up in the Atlanta penitentiary, where he nearly died. So the Socialist Party was certainly ground down by government repression. A second factor, though, was that in the wave of nationalist and xenophobic hysteria during World War I, encouraged by the federal government, a good portion of the public was also turned against
right.
against socialism. It
right.
claimed, of course, that these people were unpatriotic. They weren't supporting American troops, and therefore good patriots should never support socialism. A further factor that hurt the Socialist Party was the split
right.
over the Bolshevik Revolution,
ah.
the communist revolution that took place in Tsarist Russia. There had been revolutionary movements inside Tsarist Russia. One couldn't vote there, of course. There were no elections, Russia had a very authoritarian past. It certainly didn't have a democratic past. And so the Bolsheviks said, in the context of the World War, staged a revolution and ultimately took sole power in Russia, the largest country in the world at that time. And therefore, that example of revolution and of calling, as the Bolsheviks did, for socialism, which they called communism, of course, meant that portions, a minority in this case, of the Socialist Party in the United States and other socialist parties now said, well, the capitalists in democratic societies where elections take place don't play fair. They throw our leaders into jail. How can we possibly, take part in democratic elections? And therefore, we should rise up, as the Bolsheviks showed us, and stage revolutions. And so a portion of the Socialist Party in the United States and a portion of other socialist parties broke off, and they formed communist parties, parties that were dedicated to revolution, not to democratic elections and to civil liberties. And so from that point on, from the time of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917 on,
right,
the world socialist movement was split into socialist parties and communist parties. And they were bitter foes, in fact. They were rivals, and they preached a totally different sort of political position.
And
so that helped to split the Socialist Party in the United States, and in turn, the federal government, then horrified by this specter of revolution, began to crack down even harder on the Socialist Party, and now the Communist Party, too. And many unaffiliated radicals, unaffiliated leftists, and to deport them and to arrest them, and at times they were even lynched.
Oh, my. So then it sounds like through that process that you just described, Professor Wittner, that what had been a very respectable and respected, relatively mainstream socialist party got stuck with this image of a violent revolutionary, the Bolshevik bomb-throwing revolutionary, which for a lot of socialists wasn't at all the case, but they got plastered with that label, and it was kind of downhill from there. And ever since then, there's been this, fear works. Let's face it, fear is very, very effective. And the government, as you said, painted a picture of all socialists as fitting into this, and that you should be very, very scared of these other people. And I have to say, I'm reminded of a quote from my old friend Abby Hoffman, who used to say of the left that isms get schisms and go to wasms pretty quick. You know, it seems like that's
true.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, that's a perennial affliction of the left, these splits. So many Americans from that point on, tell me if this is right, equated legitimate electoral socialists as the same as the evil, bloody communists. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. And that was a real ball and chain, especially during the Cold War, when the Soviet Union emerged as the great foe of the United States on the world scene, and also, of course, was a very unappealing society. And the socialists, who actually were quite critical of the Soviet Union, although the communists were supportive, but the socialists who were quite critical were assumed to be supportive and assumed to be just like the communists, and in this case, just like Soviet leaders.
Right.
So it was a very unfair characterization of democratic socialists, but nonetheless, it was one that was often sticking to them and they found it hard to escape from that stereotype of themselves as simply supporters of the Soviet model for the United States, when in fact they were really supporters of the British Labour Party model, a model that brought national health care to Britain, or a model that brought other reforms to British life and made it economically more democratic, just as it remained politically democratic.
I like that, economic democracy. That's a more perhaps attractive name for what is basically the same thing. If you just tuned in to Keeping Democracy Alive, Bert Cohen here. Our guest today is history professor Lawrence Wittner. We're talking about, will Americans vote for a democratic socialist? Certainly harm was done to the brand, shall we say, in the 20th century. And it's been tough. And it was, you know, the picture that was painted of the communists, and, you know, stuck on the socialists, which wasn't at all the case. But then again, you know, Americans saw socialists the same as communists. Well, after the Debs era, Norman Thomas became what you described as an attractive, articulate leader of the Socialist Party. Tell us about his appeal, please, and what political segments were drawn to his brand of socialism.
Well, Norman Thomas was a, you know, much like Debs in terms of his views, but nonetheless, he came from a different constituency. And indeed, the of the two men in many ways symbolized the change in the Socialist Party. Aside from going downhill, it was drawing on very different forces after the hammer blows of the World War and its immediate aftermath. Debs, of course, had come out of the labor movement and had been a railway workers' leader. Norman Thomas was a Protestant clergyman, a very dignified fellow who had attended Princeton University, unlike Debs, who had left school after grade school. Debs symbolized the blue-collar worker, while Thomas, in many ways, symbolized the middle-class intellectual. And indeed, the Socialist Party, which by the 1920s was much smaller than during those first two decades of the 20th century, the Socialist Party lost much of its working class base, and was increasingly narrowed down to middle class intellectuals and reformers. Thomas symbolized those people. And he was a very attractive figure in many ways. He was very articulate. He drew a good deal of respect from these reformers. And there were some socialist-led unions, nonetheless, such as the International Ladies' Garment Workers and the Amalgamated Clothing Workers and a few others. But, you know, and they liked him, too. But what happened to Thomas was that he was campaigning for the usual socialist programs, a combination of immediate demands, such as taxing the wealthy more heavily to pay for public services, and establishing a federal minimum wage and maximum hour law, and public ownership of electric power, and a variety of other things like that. And the Democratic Party, by the 1930s, was moving in that direction. The New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt and of other Democratic liberals of the time was adopting many of those socialist programs. And the socialist vote, which had, of course, shrunk by the 1920s, continued to go down during the 1930s. And when Thomas was later asked, why the Socialist Party had crumbled during the Great Depression, when one would think that its vote would go up thanks to mass misery and a growing revolt against the wealthy and their corporations, Thomas responded, in a word, Roosevelt. What he meant, of course, was that the New Deal Democratic Party was adopting at least some of the Socialist Party programs, and therefore many old socialists were falling away from it. Let me give you one example of that.
Sure.
In the mid to late 1930s, the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, mm-hmm. Was busy organizing the mass production industries, steel, auto, textiles, and so on. And they were thereby challenging the old, more stodgy American Federation of Labor. In the auto plants, the United Auto Workers was active. It still hadn't gained union recognition, but it staged sit-down strikes. It actually took over the Chrysler and the General Motors plant,
right,
and prevented the company from operating them.
Yes, indeed.
And demanded union recognition and collective bargaining. Well, the owners of General Motors and Chrysler were just horrified by this, so they went to the governor of Michigan, a Democrat named Frank Murphy, and they demanded that he send in state troops to drive the workers out of the plants and to restore them to corporate management's control. And Murphy, under heavy pressure from the unions, refused to do that. So the companies, abandoned by the government, finally broke down, and they recognized the United Auto Workers, and they began to bargain with them. So this was an enormous breakthrough for organized labor. How would the Socialist Party deal with this? The Socialists usually ran candidates for governor of Michigan, as well as of other major industrial states, as well as for president of the United States. What should they do in this case, where a Democrat had been the key supporter of the workers and had helped the union to get established? Well, the Ruther brothers, Walter
yes.
Ruther, who was a leader of the United Auto Workers, but also his brothers Roy and Victor, went to the Socialist Party, since they were key Socialist Party activists, and they said to the Socialist Party leaders, look, don't back a candidate against Frank Murphy. The auto workers are going to have to support Murphy. But the Socialist Party said, well, we're a third party. We're not Democrats. We're going to back a Socialist Party candidate. So they did so, and Murphy lost to the Republican.
Mm.
Consequently, the Ruther brothers dropped out of the Socialist Party, and they steered the auto workers into an alliance with the Democratic Party. Walter Ruther himself became president of United Auto Workers.
Right.
He became president of the CIO. And when it merged with the AFL to form the AFL-CIO in 1955, he became the second in command of this giant labor federation, a federation that backed Democrats. So, again, it shows you how, in the end, the socialist determination to run third-party campaigns meant that the Socialist Party constituency, which might have continued as socialists but didn't want to go against the Democrats that were supporting what the socialists wanted, this constituency simply moved into the Democratic Party.
Mm. And sometimes it worked. And certainly pressure in the 1930s got Franklin Roosevelt to do what he did. He also had pressure from the populist rural area, from Huey Long. I do find it interesting that socialism and populism had been their bases had been more rural, Midwestern, and even Southern areas. And then what happened with the communists and the confusion and the inevitable splits in the leftist parties kind of made it go away, because the Democrats oftentimes adopted that. And certainly in 1962, when socialist Michael Harrington published The Other America, Lyndon Johnson took ownership of that effort and, you know, took on the socialist themes and made it into real governmental policy. And
the war on poverty.
Yes, the war on poverty. Now, of course, Reagan changed it into a war on the poor, and that has continued to this day, unfortunately. And you talk about the Democratic Party, and an old friend of mine, you probably know Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation, has long argued that the Democratic Party is really up for grabs, that we on the traditional left really should go through the structure of the Democratic Party. And it seems like that's what Bernie Sanders has decided to do. I mean, obviously, he recognized that the third party attempt of, I hate to even say his name, Ralph Nader, put George Bush in the White House. And I wonder that if it's possible that a significant number of Americans are really getting how harmful the concentration and centralization of power and wealth and authority has been, and may actually participate. There's this tremendous enthusiasm, at least right now, for Bernie Sanders, who is a democratic socialist or a socialist democrat, whatever. I wonder what you think. I mean, you're a history professor, and you know, you got to see certain trends. I don't see real enthusiasm, quite frankly, for the corporatist centrist Democratic Party of Hillary Clinton. It's just not happening there. Any kind of optimism that you may have? And what is it that Bernie is saying that only he can say that is resonating so well? Could he become the nominee?
Well, I think it's not likely that he will be the nominee. I think he may win some primaries.
Yeah.
He certainly is appealing to a substantial constituency inside the Democratic Party that is set up with corporate domination of the country and with the Democratic Party's kowtowing to the wealthy and to corporate interests. The labor movement has been unhappy with a number of things championed by Democratic presidents, such as so-called free trade, which usually means corporate-dominated trade and
outsourcing.
Workers don't and consumers don't count.
Yeah.
And the failure to strengthen labor rights through labor reform laws. There are racial minority groups that have felt abandoned by the Democratic Party, despite the fact that they're a key constituent in the party, as is the labor movement. There are a variety of reformers, from women's rights groups to corporate regulation groups, that have been unhappy with the increasing control of the Democratic Party by the wealthy and by big funders.
Yes.
Let me just turn back briefly, though,
sure,
to Michael Harrington and the old Socialist Party. There had been as the Socialist Party had almost totally collapsed by the 1960s and 1970s, a debate was going on inside it between those who still wanted to run candidates and those who said, well, the forces for social change, for social justice, for peace, are inside the Democratic Party now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should get inside the Democratic Party too, and begin to campaign among them and help to rally them around socialist programs, such as national health care, for example,
mm-hmm.
or such as ending the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And they did so. Michael Harrington led a group out that formed the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, and later Democratic Socialists of America.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's been one group. Oh, and I might mention Bernie Sanders was in the youth group of the old Socialist Party, the Young People's Socialist League, and he was very much part of those debates. Some people, though, like Sanders, decided to run as independent,
right.
Although he didn't run as an upfront socialist. He wasn't running a Socialist Party campaign. He won, as did many of those who were running inside the Democratic Party, people like Ron Dellums, for example, who became who was not just a congressman from California, but for a time was actually head of the House Armed Services Committee,
right.
And a keen critic of the military-industrial complex. So there are forces inside the Democratic Party now, including many liberals, as symbolized by Katrina VandenHeuvel's Nation magazine,
mm-hmm.
who are saying the real fight is inside the Democratic
right.
Party now.
Right.
A fight between those who are willing to compromise with the corporations and those who are willing to challenge them head on and to call for real programs that will help working people and not just the wealthy.
I always find it interesting how many people who are so adversely affected by unbridled corporate capitalism are some of its biggest defenders. It didn't used to be the case. Certainly, there's, unlike other Western European countries, there's no real sense of class here in America. And people, a lot of the people who vote Republican, who vote for the corporate elite and for the plutocrats very enthusiastically, also plead the most for capitalism. And socialism can certainly be pictured, painted anyway, as a threat to capitalism, which Americans so clearly and deeply value. Is socialism not a threat to capitalism per se?
Well, in theory, it is. In practice, what's often happened, and in fact, what has happened, where socialist parties, not communist parties, but socialist parties have come to power, is that these parties have implemented a variety of programs. Some involve public ownership. For
right.
example, the British Labour Party brought a national health care program, a publicly run and operated health care system, as well as public ownership of the rail lines and of certain giant industries like steel and coal. But for the most part, these same socialist parties have not developed public ownership in most of the economy. That is, most of it has
right.
remained capitalist.
Right.
But in terms of the commanding heights of the economy, they've sometimes nationalized, made public, certain major industries, such as the electric power industry or the telephone industry or the rail line,
mm-hmm.
or they have national health care programs.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the economies or most of the economy has remained capitalist.
Right.
So they haven't, but they've also, within that capitalist economy, they've promoted various reforms, such as guarantees of 2 months, for example, in Sweden, of paid vacation,
mm-hmm.
or maternity leaves with pay, and a variety of other things that are regulations of these capitalist enterprises. And in fact, the capitalist enterprises have thrived. They've done very
yes,
well.
Exactly.
Western Europe
yes.
Has developed economically, just as the United States, and done very well.
Yes.
And in fact, in the United States, we really have a mixed economy.
Yes, of course.
We have public schools.
Yep.
We have a whole range of public services, including the post office, which was established by the founding fathers in the United States. Now, there are corporations and conservatives that are trying to get rid
yes.
of that public sector.
Yes.
So what I'm getting at is that capitalism can survive just fine.
Right.
Corporations can, in fact, do very well, but under a socialist party or democratic socialist government, they may have to accept some measure of regulation on what they do in the economy, or some of them, particularly those that are so dominant that they're too big to fail,
yeah, right.
Perhaps they should be publicly owned,
right.
Such as the banks, for example.
Well, there are many Midwestern states, actually, that have state banks, you know, that serve the common good. And I love what Bernie Sanders said, a bank that's too big to fail is too big to exist. And I really believe that you can have a mixed economy, you know, capitalism where it works and some degree of socialism where capitalism can't fix the problem. Capitalism is not going to build new schools. It's not going to build new roads. It's not by itself going to fix our aging, you know, decrepit infrastructure. And it seems to me, like Roosevelt did, there was a lot of, right now, there's a lot of work that desperately needs to be done. A lot of people that desperately need work. Hello, you know, it's not all that complicated. And I firmly believe that some social programs can shore up capitalism. I mean, a lot of historians have argued that Franklin Roosevelt's social programs helped save capitalism, that it absolutely can exist together and should exist together. I wonder about, you know, the fear, you know, is here we have Bernie Sanders, who's been exceedingly popular. Recent polls show that people do support socialist ideas. To what degree do you think socialism is still seen as this scary other, or are the imprints of, you know, the Iron Curtain, the jackbooted Soviet coming down, you know, the whole 50s picture of communism and describing, you know, socialism as the same thing as communism, is it still seen as the scary other, or do you think there is some change?
Well, recent polls, and I don't know of the poll you mentioned, but the latest poll I've seen, which was conducted by the Pew Research Center,
oh, very reputable,
in September of 2011, showed that 31% of the population responded positively to the word socialism. That is the U.S. population. Now, the rest didn't. That is, the other 69% didn't. But nonetheless, there's a substantial chunk of people in the United States that, you know, view it positively. Now, if the word or words were democratic socialism, I suspect there would be a larger positive response to it, because
yes,
that would imply, at least, that one was not talking about communism. So I think there are many people that still fear socialism, probably most, but nonetheless, there's an increasing number that seem to view it quite positively. And it seems to me that whether Bernie Sanders wins or loses this time around, his candidacy is going to help popularize the term democratic socialism, and popularize democratic socialist ideas and make them much less scary to the average American.
Yeah, and I wonder, I mean, there's the term populism. I mean, Bernie Sanders is definitely a populist. Populism and populism has been around since before the actual founding of the country. You know, it's been with us since Shays' Rebellion, things like that. I wonder about possibly using that word. But then again, you know, as has been said in campaigns, when you are explaining, you are losing. And explaining socialism is a difficult thing to do. And I don't know. What are your thoughts on any chances of success? And
I think that Sanders is definitely going to be asked, and he is being asked,
yeah,
what, you know, what he's talking about when he sees socialism, or mm-hmm, you know, how can you talk about socialism when clearly that's a horrible thing,
yeah,
blah, blah,
right,
blah. So he's going to have to explain. But nonetheless, it's clear that's not going to be his theme song.
Right.
His theme song's going to be a fight back against the billionaire class.
Right.
Let's fight for a just and more equitable society.
Yeah.
And that sounds populist, and it is populist. And so I think that he'll do better the more he stresses social justice, and the less he has to explain away the word socialism.
Yeah, and I think he's been very, very effectively on the offensive. Go ahead, Lawrence.
Well, I think that it is time, though, Americans got beyond this phobia about socialism and understood what it is and what it is not, and understood that in fact many enterprises in the United States are publicly owned.
Yes.
And furthermore, that socialism can be and is a variety of things, whether that means public ownership, whether that means workers-controlled enterprises, whether that means co-ops, or whether that means public control through regulation of big business. So I think that it's about time Americans discarded this phobia about socialism and understood what it is and what it is not. And if they don't want government regulation of big business, and if they don't want workers' control, if they don't want some measure of public ownership, then they're welcome to vote against it. But they shouldn't vote against a phantom,
against
a myth.
Absolutely. And, you know, one can still be a patriotic American, one can still like capitalism and be a socialist at the same time. Absolutely can happen. Well, thank you so much. This has been very, very interesting. Our guest has been Dr. Lawrence Wittner. His newest book is What's Going On at You, Aardvark? Sounds like a lot of fun, a political satire. We do like political satire. Thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Thank you, Bert. Well, don't you let nobody turn you around, turn you around, turn you around. Well, don't you let nobody turn you around. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land. Hey! You let nobody turn you round. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land. Well, don't you let the policeman turn you round, turn you round, turn you round. Well, don't let the policeman turn you round. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land. Well, don't let the politician turn you round. Slow you down, well, don't let the politician slow you down. You got to keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land. Keep on walking, keep on talking, marching to the freedom land. Well, don't you let go.